When we talk about cost of goods sold, we're talking about a percentage, right? And ours is an industry of percentages. We live and die by our margins, but that doesn't mean there aren't other considerations. There very much are. Today, I'm joined by my good friend and colleague, Jim Taylor. He runs Benchmark 60. He's here to talk all about cost of goods sold because he sees things differently. And I like that there's going to be a little argument back and forth, a little bit of a disagreement, because I see things one way, he sees things another, and neither way is wrong. But I think having a full understanding of this conversation will help you be a better owner and operator. Don't go anywhere. There's an old saying that goes something like this. You'll only find three kinds of people in the world. Those who see, those who will never see, and those who can see when shown. This is Restaurant Strategy, a podcast with answers for anyone who's looking. Everyone, thanks for tuning in. My name is Chip Close. I am your host here of the Restaurant Strategy Podcast. We put out two new episodes every single week. I also put out tons of content all over the internet. You can find me on YouTube, Instagram, Facebook, TikTok. All tips, tactics, strategies meant to help you level up and build a more profitable restaurant. I also host a coaching program. It's called the P3 Mastermind. To date, over the last 5 years, we've put more than 520 people through the program. The program has grown because the program works. The P3 Mastermind is where you go to level up, to drill down, dial in profits, and figure out a way to grow. So if you are struggling with profit and growth, then it's worth a conversation. RestaurantStrategyPodcast.com/schedule. Grab some time on the calendar. You'll chat with me or someone from my team, and let's just see if you're a good fit. Again, RestaurantStrategyPodcast.com/schedule. As always, you're going to find that link in the show notes. Now, if you've listened to this show for any length of time, you've heard me talk about Kickfin because they've been a trusted partner of mine for years, and I genuinely believe in what they do for restaurant operators. See, managing tips has always been a headache. There's never enough cash in the drawer at the end of the night. Managers are stuck making bank runs throughout the day and then doing spreadsheet math at, 1, 2 in the morning. Tip pooling regulations keep getting more complex. It's just not fun. And that's exactly why Kickfin exists. With Kickfin, restaurants can calculate tip pools automatically and send instant cashless tip payouts to employees' existing bank accounts. And I said, cashless, no cash, no predatory pay cards, no glitchy employee apps required. Your team gets their tips fast in the account they choose right when their shift ends. Kickfin integrates with all the major POS players, so Toast, Square, SkyTab, Genius, Union, and many more. So you get fully automated end-to-end tip management. It's fast, it's accurate, and it gives you a clean digital record for accounting and compliance. Kickfin powers tip payouts for every type of concept, from mom-and-pop shops to regional hospitality groups to national brands like Walk-On Sports Bistro, Marco's Pizza, and Toasted Yolk Cafe. Great hospitality starts behind the scenes. When your people feel valued, when they are paid fairly and paid fast, I promise everything improves, and Kickfin makes that possible. If you're ready to save hours every week, eliminate those cash runs, streamline your accounting, and make tip payouts the best part of everyone's day, visit kickfin.com/demo, and yes, that link is in the show notes. All right, so my guest on today's show, thrilled to welcome back Jim Taylor. He's the founder and CEO of Benchmark 60. He's written a couple of good books, Bold Operations, Bold Consulting. He is one of my absolute favorite people in the world. He is super knowledgeable, another fellow coach like me, and I'm thrilled to call him both a friend and a colleague. We're going to talk about something very specific today, but Jim, why don't you say hello and give yourself a proper introduction, anything I didn't get to.
Great introduction. I appreciate it. It's good to get a chance to come in and hang out with again on the show. Getting invited once was special. Getting to come back a second time is even better. So thanks for the opportunity.
This will not be the last. I've always loved our conversations, both when we hit record and just in private. I think there are a bunch of people out there who know what they're doing. I think very few people who know what they're doing and can really articulate it well. And I think that's a superpower. I work very, very hard to be able to get good at articulating what I do, how I do it, how others should do it. And I think this is something you are very, very good at. I think you've got the humility and patience required to be very good at coaching, working with clients in that way. One of the things that we started chirping about on LinkedIn was talking about cost of goods sold. And you said something that I sort of pushed back on because I agreed with what you wrote. But I also see it a different way. Why don't you bring everybody up to speed? What was the post that you had posted? What was the point you were trying to make? And then I'll come in and sort of talk about my my caution, the hazard lights. And I think we'll have a really good conversation that stems from that.
Well, there's probably a few different ways that we could go in this conversation in terms of the actual specifics of the post or which one it was. But I am definitely sure that it was something contrarian about, you know, high food cost is your friend or high food cost doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Or something along those lines, right? Yes. Because it's amazing how often people get caught up in the percentages when there's other things to consider. So, it may have started a bit of a debate between the two of us, but it's healthy.
Yeah, so Jim was talking about, ours is an industry of margins, and with such tight profits, we have to be mindful of the margins, right? We have to keep labor in check, we have to keep our beverage cost, our food cost in check. We have to make sure that the lease we're signing is at a specific percentage of our targeted revenue if we want to have anything left over at the bottom. And one of the points, because you're right, it was a contrarian post, and you do that really well, and I try to be good at it as well. One of the things was, high food cost is your friend, and you were really starting a conversation about contribution margin, and you're basically saying, hey, you know, we're targeting a 28% food cost, but I had a client who had an item, you know, we decided to, you know, go all in, and it ended up being a 42% food cost, but the contribution margin, like what it delivered in gross profit, was way more than everything else, which was quote unquote, like in the pocket in our 26, 27, 28% food cost. But look at this one item that was 42% is actually contributing way more to the bottom line than the other things. And I pushed back on this and I said, I obviously agree. And there's a certain percentage of items on a menu that I think you can have there. But I think it's hard to make an entire menu of those things. And the idea is, hey, if all your entrees are $28, $30, $32, having a $58 something at a 42% cost is still dropping more to the bottom line than any of the, you know, it's the $58 steak is actually dropping more to the bottom line in gross profit than a $28 chicken, which is right, except it begs the question, like, we can't have an entire menu of $58 steaks on there because everybody is thinking about, you know, they only have so much wallet size and things like that. Mm-hmm. And so the answer can't be, I think the danger of what you were saying and what I posted, and I know you were being contrarian just to get somebody like me to take the bait. But I think the danger there is everyone say, well, it doesn't matter because look at the contribution margin, because when you get an entire menu of that, it can be very, very dangerous.
Sure.
Talk to me where we go in this conversation after that.
Well, there's two immediate things that pop into my mind. I mean, the one which you touched on, the, you know, $58 steak or those types of things, the general sort of basis of how I always think about menus is, first of all, I would way rather sell a 40% food cost item that makes $18 when we sell one than a 22% food cost item that makes $4 when we sell one or $6. Sure. You know, that's... And if we miss the math on that part from a dollars perspective, the whole menu becomes less profitable. So that's one, sure, one piece. The other piece is that we have to, and this is where, you know, I love the discussion that this type of thing, yep, creates. We have to factor in sales mix, right? Because if what scares me sometimes with menus in restaurants is if we write the whole menu at 26% food cost, because we want to end up with 26% food cost, we're actually doing ourselves a disservice, yeah, by leaving a lot of money on the table.
I agree. So right? Explain further and, there, because I think I know where you're going to go. Let me pull up that thread though. Give me an example in real time.
Well, we see restaurants all the time actually that they either have written their whole menu priced at 26% food cost because that's where they want to end up, or they don't understand how sales mix impacts the blend to get to 26% food cost. You know, and I'll hold myself accountable here. based on the post that you're talking about, if we're going to have 40 or 42% food cost items on the menu, we also have to have 18, 19, 20% food cost items on the menu.
Sure.
And some are going to move more than others.
So I want everyone to hear that. So Jim, it's okay to have a item on your menu that's 18% food cost, right?
Absolutely.
So I was talking about McDonald's, right? Number one item on the McDonald's product mix is the French fries. French fries sell at approximately a 7% cost. And knowing that they are making money hand over fist every time they sell you fries doesn't make you the consumer, at least doesn't make me the consumer, frustrated or angry. I'm not like, oh, that's a ripoff. They're not a ripoff because they're worth it. That's the best part of a meal there. I'm not going to go get a quarter pounder and not get fries, just like a psychopath sits in the corner with just a Big Mac and no fries. Like you got to have the fries. But they can lose money, not lose money, but they can lose margin on certain items because they know they're making it up with their number one item on their product mix coming in at roughly a 7.1% food cost.
There's always opportunity to have low cost items on the menu for sure. And some of them move like crazy, right? As long as they meet the labor model, which is another part of the conversation, then it's a good thing.
Yeah. One of the things that that we've lost over the last, I'll say 15 years or so, to take this, because we're still talking about cost of goods, this beverage programs and the way that now every restaurant needs to have a list of specialty cocktails, which I don't know that they do. Mm. I think it's nice if you want to just highlight, feature some that are quick grabs. You're giving people an idea so they don't have to think too hard about what they want. That's the point of a specialty cocktail list, not to show off sort of the prowess of your mixologist or your bar director or whatever, which is now what it's become. And it's become multiple touches and finding really unique, hey, like, oh, look at all the Amaros we're using in these things and finding really like quirky, unique stuff. But it's not. It's meant to be a quick call sheet. So somebody sees something really delicious and goes, oh, that sounds great. Yeah, I'll start with that. It's the whole point 20 years ago of having a list of specialty cocktails was to make it really easy and frictionless to get a first drink on the table. And now it's just turned into something else. To that point, those specialty cocktails years ago where we'd have like 3 or 5 on there instead of 8 or 12 or 15, they came in at like an 8, 9, 10, 12% food cost because we are beverage cost because we had really great deals with our liquor reps. And we say, hey, listen, man, I'm going to put one vodka cocktail on the menu, one whiskey cocktail, one rum cocktail, and I'm going to move a ton of it. So what can you do for me with the pricing? And so we got really, really great pricing. So not only did this make it really easy for someone to order something really quickly, so me to get that drink on the table, but because I was going to move so much product, because I only had a couple of these specialty cocktails, I knew I could get preferred pricing with my vendors. Sure. And so I wanted people to order these because I made more money. It was more money than if they just got an old fashioned, than if they had just gotten a martini.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
100%. I saw actually witnessed a really interesting and really, simple yet innovative way to do exactly what you're talking about. Just the other day, we were out for dinner at a steakhouse, not overly fancy steakhouse. And I hadn't seen this happen in a very long time. Every table, when they sat down, the waiter or the person taking care of them came over to the table with a champagne cart, right? Old school, simple. They had the lowest end Prosecco that was on that champagne cart was selling for $12 a glass. I mean, we're not talking about having to buy hundreds of dollars worth of bubbles. They did have very expensive, Dom Perignon at $125 type thing a glass. But the thing that was fascinating, talking about speed of service, getting a beverage in someone's hand, and at a good cost percentage, we watched, and it was like 80% of people in the room ordered something off that cart.
Yeah, 100%. I was just working with a client. I was just on site out in Ohio about 3 weeks ago. And we talked about, we call them speed bumps, right? That all these little things, these moments that make you go, oh, that's cool. Oh, a champagne cart being wheeled over to the table. You go, oh, that's interesting. And the best restaurants have, a dozen of them. Sure. So that you're not going to get them all. But over the course of the night, you're going to see maybe 3, 4, 5 of them. And you're going to go, that's going to be something that sticks in your brain. Just like the champagne cart. You're like, oh, that's different. That's interesting. And we were talking about, it's this Italian restaurant. And the whole dance was between you know, there's they're in a community that has a huge population of Italian Americans, and yet they don't necessarily know this like traditional like Italian, specifically like Northern Italian sort of vibe. And one of the things they said, I said, you know, why don't you? One of the things we talked about, because they do some of this cart service for different items, and I said, why don't you just get one of these carts, wheel it around, and put all these aperitifs on there, and say this is like a traditional way to start a meal. When you're in Florence, when you're in Milan, when you're like, that's what you're doing. Everybody's going out for a drink before they get to dinner. So just do this, wheel it over and say, hey, it's, you know, traditional in Italy. If you were at a, you know, any cafe in Milan, you would go to the place next door, have a drink before you came over here. So what would you like? Would you like, you know, any of these, and have 8 or 10 options here? So number one, culturally, you're introducing people to something they would naturally do anyway, and you're getting that drink. It's just, it was such a no-brainer. Mm-hmm. And they said, well, I don't know if people will do it. I said, it costs us absolutely nothing to try it for 30 days and see if we can't talk them into it. If for nothing else, for the novelty of it, I said, and pour them little tastes. Say, do you want to, you know, try something? If you find something, you know, if you see something you know you love, I'm happy to get you a glass of it. And if you don't know something, if you want to try it, by all means, I'll pour you a taste of it. And they're like, oh, that was like... It just kept getting better as we continue the conversation. And we just, this is absolutely, I mean, by the time I walked out the door 4 days later, they were like, we're absolutely going to do this. Yeah. This is so, so cool.
And if you consider, I mean, you're talking about it from an experience and service and tradition and culture perspective. If you then could go and connect that to the business model, I mean, sure. They have a $125 glass of Dom on that cart. They have a $7 glass of Prosecco and 3 or 4 options in the middle. The blended average probably adds at when 80% order one, it's adding $2, $3, $4 to every average check of every single guest. I mean, that is substantial.
At least. And so to be honest, we were coming at it from both directions. So we, you know, people were starting at the end of the race, coming to the middle. People were starting at the beginning of the race. So culturally, aesthetically, you know, experientially, we were having the conversation. But the first thing we were trying to solve was, how do we increase check average? Because we looked at it and said, if we increase check average by $6 per head, it changes the entire economics of this model. And it was like, great, well, how do we do that? And I said, great, that's the right question. We can do this not just by one thing, but by a series of things.
Yeah.
I said, but missing that first beat is such a missed opportunity. Jim, this is the Olive Garden. This is what the Olive Garden did in the 90s, if you remember this. Olive Garden walked over, right, with a whole bunch, you know, they had, the table was all set with silverware and wine glasses. And the server walked over with a bottle of wine that they were featuring. I'm sure somebody at corporate decided what they were featuring that week. And they came down and say, hey, how's everyone doing tonight? My name's Chip. Welcome to the Olive Garden. Quick question. I would love to start you off with just a little taste of this Chianti we're featuring, blah, 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 blah. It's $42 a bottle if you decided to have it. This bottle's yours. I just opened it. And if you don't like it, at least, you know, we're just, you know, welcoming you with a little bit of wine. And they pour it for everybody. Oh, it's really good. I said, great. You want to just keep it? And I said, great. And they would just pour the rest of the wine. And it was like they made, you know, I always say first approach is about selling that beverage, but like they increased the check average because they really put their money where their mouth was. They walked over with it. And now we didn't invent this. Like, we didn't invent this. And guess what? Olive Garden didn't invent it either. Like Uncle Giuseppe in, you know, whatever, you know, Casino, you know, outside of Rome, like they've been doing this for like 200 years. Right. Like, you know, the best way to do this is just get somebody some wine in the glass. They're never going to turn down that free half glass, and then they'll just have more of this same thing.
Absolutely.
Ajinomoto is your answer to every busy dinner rush spent deep in the weeds. When hungry customers walk through your door, they expect good food, right? Good food that tastes homemade. But making every dish from scratch can cut into your profits. Certainly what we're talking about today, especially with the cost of ingredients and, yes, the cost of labor. That's where Ajinomoto Foods comes in. Ajinomoto has a huge catalog of fast, easy-to-prep frozen Asian products that taste and look homemade. That includes classics like fried rice, dumplings, and onion rings, and new trendy fusion plates like kimchi chicken pot stickers. See, choosing Ajinomoto is choosing over 100 years of proven expertise in the food service space. Choose to save time, choose to save money in your busy kitchen without compromising on the quality your customers have come to expect. Learn more about Ajinomoto at ajinomotofoodservice.com, and yes, you'll find that link in the show notes. When you talk about that product mix, right? The sales mix. How do you, are there any hard and fast rules that you think about when we talk about sort of middle of the bunch, bottom of the bunch, top of the bunch? How do you approach it?
Well, you know, there's the sort of, I guess, traditional way of looking at menu engineering and menu mix around, you know, the plow horse and the dog and the, you know, the winner and all those different things. We always just try to start really simple. If you can actually print off or look at your sales mix, only, I should be careful I say this, but I will say it, only the top 10% of your items really matter if you're trying to move the needle on cost of goods from a sales mix perspective. Because, you know, I was talking to a chef not long ago and we were encouraging them to make sure they had recipes for every item on their menu because they had no recipes.
Yeah.
Their menu was costed at, let's say 28%, but they had no recipes. So they didn't know what was happening from a variance perspective, what was actually happening, you know, actual versus theoretical, a different conversation again. But he said, I just don't have time to get all these recipes done. You know how long that'll take me? My restaurant's busy. I'm in the mix. I'm on the fryer. I'm whatever. We said, just find the top 10 items that sell the most of your menu, maybe even top five, depending how big the menu is, and make sure you have recipes for those. And then let's work on making sure those recipes are optimized because, you know, the batch of ranch dip that gets made that you sell a few of here and there at the end of the day, that recipe doesn't really matter that much when it comes to overall profit. And so anyway, the point that I'm trying to make here is we see people get so caught up in all of the work that it takes to try and do that whole menu. Only the top 10% matters.
Yep. Talk to me. I come from the school where the number one item in your product mix also should be the number one most profitable item in your business. Do you subscribe to that?
I subscribe to if we take an approach, and I agree with you, but we take an approach of look at the average contribution and cost of goods percentage for every item of the top 10% on your menu. If an item is green in both, right? It's good from a cost of goods perspective and it's above average in terms of your contribution. Do as much as you possibly can to sell a whole lot of it. If it's below in either of them, you should either re-engineer the recipe or change the price. If it's red in both, maybe it should come off the menu. So we try to keep that as simple as possible, but I do agree with you in terms of what you're saying for sure.
I think at the end of the day, I don't want that much on my menu. I feel like over the 90s and early 2000s, we got into these bigger and bigger and bigger menus. And everybody says, oh, you come from fine dining. You're used to, you know, these tight little menus, which I might be a little bit guilty of. But mostly when I go somewhere, I want to know, like, what should I get here? Like, what are you famous for? And I want it to be really, really obvious. I don't want people, okay, so page 3, at the very bottom, you'll see this. It's like, just tell me what you're famous for. Just tell me what I should get here and make it really, really easy. It's like Egg Slut here in New York City. Like, what are they famous for? I don't know. The one thing that they'll sell you, like that's what they're famous for. Just get that. It's like, just do that.
So true. Yeah. Keeping the menu tight makes it easier to control the cost, the inventory, you know, your pricing strategy. I mean, all of those things, it gets easier. The tighter the menu, I would agree for sure.
It makes marketing easier too. Because then you're in a category of one. Like, we're the place you come for this. Like, I think it's going to get really, really hard as we move forward if we don't have these tight, focused menus. And I don't mean so tight that there's no variety. Because if you want someone to come out there multiple times in a month, they don't necessarily always want to come get the chicken, even if the chicken is what you're famous for. It's like, ah, the chicken's so good, but I'm really in the mood for, you know, fish tonight. Like, you want to be able to give them some room to do that, but it should also be really, really clear who you are, what your point of view is, and like what you do better than anybody else, and why. Because really, we're answering that question, that value prop question, right? What do you have that, you know, what makes somebody choose one thing over another? What do you have that they can't get anywhere else?
You know what? There's a quote that I love by a woman named Frances Fry, who wrote an incredible book called Uncommon Service. And she explains in really good detail, if you've never read this book, that if you want to be great at one thing, and I think this applies to restaurants so well, if you want to be great at one thing, you intentionally have to be bad at something else.
I love that. How does that play out in real life?
Well, I think it applies in a few ways. I think it applies to restaurants in one way, specifically about what you're talking around menu size. If you want to be really, really good at being famous for one or two things, you actually have to intentionally be bad at variety.
I think that's really great. This is the Cheesecake Factory is the opposite thing, right? And people are like, you know, the Cheesecake Factory, their differentiator is variety, but their downside is that none of it's particularly great. Like they're not great at anything. They're great at variety, but everything else is like, okay. Like everything on the menu is okay. It's not, you know, you're not going to be insulted, but you're also not going to like write a book about it.
Right. And you know, this could apply to, for example, a fine dining restaurant. If you want to be the best and be great at quality and still be profitable and run a sustainable business, then you intentionally have to be bad at price. You have to be expensive.
Yep.
Right. It's just a different lens to look through. If you look at, you know, the In-N-Out burgers of the world, if you want to be in really, really good at quality and speed and consistency, again, they're bad at variety because they want to be laser focused. So it's just that I always find it to be an interesting lens to look through.
Love
it's like,
that,
what are
Jim.
We trying to be great at in exchange for something we're actually okay with not being good at? Because you can't be great at everything.
I love that. The way we started this conversation was talking about that contribution margin and having, I want to loop back around because I want to have one final conversation around this before I kick you out of here. The conversation around this is, you know, that people are hurting and that, you know, their dollar's not stretching as far as it did. And one of the first things that they cut out of their monthly budget is dinners out. And we're definitely seeing that. I know the people listening to this are feeling that. So when we talk about hey, having this higher margin item, but it's actually dropping more to the bottom line. But now we get into this conversation of, well, people, you know, are looking at the 28 versus the 58 and they're going, yeah, actually, but I can't justify spending that. So I'm just going to get something lower. How do we apply that same way of thinking? Like, you know, how do we take the learnings from this, which, yep, you actually make more money from it, but you have to ask people to spend more money on that item. So dinner out is more expensive and we're watching people, you know, really lean more into these like value meals. And I think things are bifurcating. I've been saying this for the last 18 months. I'm watching it in real time. Cheap convenience, fast food, quick service. It's like, it's exploding. And then also fine dining, I think has never been more popular than it is now. And I think we're watching all this stuff in the middle is really suffering. So how do we apply, or how should we be thinking about that idea of margin, PMIX, contribution margin, you know, in the current climate?
Well, one thing that I always encourage people to do once they look at that contribution dollars in combination with percentage, because both are very important. If we're worried about value prop, you know, more than we ever have been, or we're worried about guest visit count, or we're worried about, you know, those types of things like you were describing, there's a really interesting thing that can happen when you work on your menu from that perspective. And we actually encourage this all the time. There are items on your menu that you probably should increase the price on, right? But there are also items on your menu that you could easily decrease the price on and still be profitable. So that item that's 42% food cost that makes $18 when you sell one, if your average contribution is $10, you've got $7 of wiggle room there where you're still above average. You're not going to want to drop at $7, but you could probably drop the cost, the price of that item by $1.50, $2, and you're still going to be very profitable every time you sell one.
Yep.
So that's an interesting exercise. And it also helps from a customer service perspective, because if a customer walks in and says, you know what, things are expensive and it looks like you've raised your prices, think about how powerful it is when you can say, you know what, there are certain things we've had to raise. Here are some items that we actually lowered the price on these to make sure that we're still taking good care of you.
I love that. It's also using, this is as good a time as any to remind people about the idea of price anchoring, right? Is that in every category of your menu, you really should have a more expensive, a meaningfully more expensive, like 40 to 50% more expensive than everything else. Simply because human beings, and there's all this data that shows human beings are really bad at affixing value to a thing, but they're really good at comparing value, comparing one thing against the other. So this steak versus the steak I had last week, this steak versus the other steak that's on the menu, that kind of thing. And so there's this famous experiment that was done, like the Opus One, they call it the Opus One effect, that we have a wine list, 50 item, you know, 50 different wines in the list. Most expensive is the Stag's Leap wine, Stag's Leap Cabernet. It's on there for $135. you know, consultant comes in and, you know, says, oh, we never move this. Nobody wants to spend that much money. You know, we move like two or three every single month. And he says, wait, just watch. And he adds a bottle of Opus One to the menu for $385. So now most of the wines are between like 50 and 70. Then you get one at 135, then another one at 385. What you find is that you sell two or three bottles of the Opus One because somebody always wants to get the most expensive one. But then you move like 20 or 30 bottles of the Stag's Leap simply because it looks so much more reasonable. It looks so much closer to the other ones. People are like, well, I want something really good, but I don't need to go crazy, so I'll just get this thing. Where 30 days prior, 60 days prior, that was the thing that they were like, well, we don't need to get crazy here. Let's just, and they made a decision based on people want good stuff, but they don't want to seem ostentatious. They don't want to, you know, feel like they're, you know, they're overspending on stuff. That idea of price anchoring is so key. It's such an easy thing to do.
And the price anchor item could run at 60% wine cost and still be more profitable than every other wine on the menu.
100%. I mean, this is where you get, you know, these big first growth Bordeaux's, or you get fancy Burgundy. You know, when you get something on there for hundreds or thousands of dollars, it still makes more, my bottle of $100, $135 Stag's Leap that's in there for like a 25, 26% cost. And then again, my bottle of, you know, whatever it is at 60, 70% cost, it's still making so much more money off of it.
Right.
This point of contribution margin.
And this applies, you know, we're talking about some fine dining and some, you know, hundreds of dollars for a bottle of wine or thousands. This applies to, like you said, McDonald's French fries. This applies to the $7 appetizer on your menu. This applies to the $14 burger, whatever, you know, type of concept it is. The same math exercise applies.
100%. You know, it's funny. One of the items that I've told people to get off their menu, like almost across the board over the last 3 years, has been charcuterie plates, right? They put together this beautiful charcuterie plate with meats and cheeses and nuts and, you know, grapes and all of that. And so the problem is, you know, it's the most expensive appetizer on the table, but they get one for the center of the table. Six people just sort of like pick on it while they're waiting for their entrees. So the $45 appetizer divided by six people, you're like, actually, I don't want that. I want everyone to order a $14, $15 appetizer rather than $6, $7, $8, you know, for the check average. People are like, yeah, but it looks so beautiful. I'm like, I don't care. We're not making money on it.
100%. You know, and maybe there is an opportunity to have a third discussion about this one day, because then you start to think about, how does that item connect to your labor model? And is it actually good or bad for the labor model? The example we always use, charcuterie is one of them. The other example we always use is an item like lobster bisque. If you have to store 100 frozen lobsters in your freezer all the time and go through all of the process to make lobster bisque, it might have good cost of goods and good contribution, but it could actually be hurting your labor model.
It's funny, Jim, I feel like I've been talking about this a lot over the last year. I said, does everybody here have a winter menu? I'll talk to my group, you know, the P3 Mastermind. I said, does everyone have a winter menu? And they just sort of look at me. They're like, well, I mean, we make some seasonal changes. I was like, no. We're talking about a winter menu. And like, what do you mean? I was like, you make half, or, you know, it's, I don't know, it's a 40% decrease in revenue between Q4 and Q1, at least in New York City, for example. So with less revenue, you have to tighten up labor. Just it's necessary to do so. And you need a menu that can be, you know, low on prep and easy to execute on the pickup, so that you don't have all these guys coming in to like shave carrots and chop onions and all that stuff. And also, so you can run, instead of the five guys in the kitchen, you can just run with three or four. And so you got to have one guy running saute and grill, or one guy doing saute and fry. You know, all of that is fixed on the pickup. That's fixed in prep and pickup. So that's why we get short rib, not because we're like, ooh, short rib, hearty. It's like, no, man, because we can have that thing sort of like cooking off all day long while I'm doing the rest of my prep. And then on the pickup, man, that's just super easy to sear up for like 90 seconds in the pan. Yeah. It's so easy to execute for, you know, for one dude.
100%. Yeah.
I love it.
There's so much there to unpack, for sure.
All right, Jim, we're going to do this. We're going to have another conversation, talk about labor, because it's something I'm very, very passionate about. Last words of wisdom, sort of final takeaways for the audience here based on today's conversation.
Well, I think this is an easy one. Sometimes you challenge me in other ways, but this is an easy one. There's really simple math that you could do there, right? Like I said, think about it in terms of green or red. Is it green in terms of cost of goods percentage above or below average on your menu? Is it green or red in terms of contribution dollars above or below average on your menu? That'll give you a really easy indicator of which items are good, which items need work, and how to make the menu more profitable.
I love it. Jim, where can people go to connect with you, learn more about what you do?
LinkedIn's the easiest place to find me. Benchmark60.com is the other place that you can locate us. Happy to connect anytime, and thanks for the chance to chat again.
Perfect. Of course, we will put all of those links in the show notes. Jim, I appreciate you being here to have this conversation. To all of the listeners, I appreciate you guys making this part of your week. I know there's a ton of great podcasts. I probably listen to the same ones you do. A ton of really great podcasts out there. I appreciate you making this part of your mix. A reminder, if you get any sort of value from this show, I make this plea every so often. Go to Apple Podcasts, leave us a rating and review. You don't have to lie. Just let people know what you get out of the show, why you find value here, why you keep showing up, and why you think other people should show up. That, more than anything, would help my small business. Jim, thank you very much. Everybody listening, thank you very much.